Hello and welcome to the second ever Squawker Football IQ podcast. Today I've got a panel of three guests here and we'll be looking ahead at 2017, looking at an analytical preview of next year in football. Joining me today is Squawker's very own Adam Cheng from the gaming side of things. Hi Adam.
Hello, how are you?
Very good, thank you. And also our guest for today from the Financial Times is John Byrne Murdoch. Hi John.
Hi George, thanks for having me here.
No problem at all. And a very special guest is Squawker's very own CEO, Sanj Atwal. Hi, Sanj.
Hey, George. Thank you. Not that special.
Oh, well, it's an absolute honour to have you here as a CEO. I can tell you that one.
You say all the right things before Christmas, isn't
it? I know. Looking forward to my Christmas bonus. So, to start off with, I think whilst we're looking ahead at next year's year of football, it's only right that we should look back at 2016 first, so we know where we're coming from before we look at where we're going to. Adam, have there been any tactical trends that you've picked up on, anything that you've noticed throughout the year?
The biggest trend for me, George, has been teams using unorthodox formations and players in unorthodox positions. We've seen it for a number of years at the highest level, teams like Germany, Spain on the international scene and at the club level, Bayern Munich and Barcelona. But I think since the additions of to the Premier League, Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola, I think we've seen that philosophy in this country, and it's not just at highest level as well, it's going down to teams like Watford and Swansea that play with, you don't know what formation they're playing half the time. They're playing wing backs that are playing in midfield. Obviously Guardiola's inverted fullbacks, you've got fullbacks either wanting to attack or needing to play in midfield, you've got strikers that are playing on the wing, you've got number 10s that are playing up front. So I think it's just an effort to be more, the word,
more unpredictable, maybe.
But yeah, more unpredictable, more advanced, I'd say. Like gone are the days of, you know, a back four, Dixon, Bold, Adams, Winterburn, and now you've got all sorts going on at Man City, for example.
And it's interesting how you bring up that maybe that's been taken from international football. International football is obviously something that at the moment a lot of people seem to not have much time for. Yet maybe we're seeing the influence of international managers and international tactics coming into the Premier League.
Having said that, though, we did have Leicester winning the Premier League with a pretty rigid system.
I mean, we'll come to that later.
John, I know that you are particularly interested in some of Pep's tactics or lack of them, maybe.
Yeah, well, it's less a lack. I think it's more the rigidity, and this is a thing that various people have, other people in the media have picked up on recently. Alison Rudd, in particular, in the latest Times podcast, I think you can almost group Guardiola together with Mourinho and Wenger. They have very different styles, but in terms of the fact that they've now become so associated with their style, it's almost like they've bought into their own hype, or maybe on a subconscious level they just feel that they have to stick to their brand. And I think, yeah, we saw that. I mean, this is looking back at the last weekend rather than the last year, but we really saw that, I think, in full effect with City's defeat to Leicester, where if you look at City's high line, we know they play that way, but the fact that they didn't react at all to Leicester given what happened last season, if you look at big teams who've lined up against Leicester so far in this campaign, they all seem to have adjusted. They've all played deeper, whereas City stuck to what they've always done and paid for it. So I think it's this idea that perhaps some teams have got too stuck to their, some managers are too loyal to their beliefs and, yeah, don't actually adjust for their opposition.
Certainly. I think looking back to that first game of the season, Pep's first game in charge in the Premier League against Sunderland, I think I've ever seen such a tactical, you know, phenomenon as what I was watching on TV. Yet they really struggled against Sunderland to actually beat them. Another new manager in the Premier League is Jurgen Klopp, who surprisingly Sanj wants to talk about. He's brought an incredible breath of fresh air to the Premier League, undoubtedly, in the kind of 8-12 months that he's been here. A bit of a wobble now. I mean, what have you made of his tactics at Liverpool?
I think he's been very astute with what he's had, with the tools that he's had. We know from history that Klopp isn't someone who likes to just splurge in the transfer market and buy lots of players, and he likes to work with what he's got. Kind of following on with what Adam said about managers coming in and really changing how they're using players. Got James Milner as one of the most consistent left backs in the Premier League. Guys, listen, I can say that again. Milner is one of the most consistent left backs in the Premier League right now. Jordan Henderson has been reinvented as a defensive midfielder. You know, who could have thought that 12 months ago, longer than that? I think what Klopp's done has been really, really intelligent with the front four. Injuries are really hitting him hard now, and I think it was very interesting, the Bournemouth game, which I was at, where the pressing, and this is not my work, by the way, this is the fantastic work of the guys at Anfield Index, Dan Kennett, and the guys at Gags. There's a fantastic pod called Under Pressure, if you're a Liverpool fan, listen to that. But I think the stat that came out was the pressing rate that Liverpool were producing in the first half against Bournemouth was their highest of the season, and in the second half they were over 50% down on season average, and you're wondering why a collapse kind of ensued. But this is the kind of stuff that's been reintroduced to Liverpool Football Club. We didn't have this before. Certainly not back in the Hodgson days, anyway.
What I would say about Pep and Klopp is that I think in both cases, it's a work in progress. Especially in terms of Pep, you know, he's been here, a few months. And I think they're both sort of less so Klopp, obviously, because he's been here longer. But I think they're both still getting to know their team and trying things out. That, you know, Pep's building something for the long term. I think he's got Gabriel Jesus coming in this window, and the general sign it's Sané, you know, young. I just think that it's more a long-term project.
I think that's exactly right. I think that there are lots of managers across Europe who people were very excited about their arrivals, Mourinho being another one, Unai Emery at PSG as well, who may be struggling a little bit, so maybe 2017 will be the year where their philosophies start to really come to the fore. So now we can leave 2016 behind a few weeks early and move on to 2017. And I think the first place we should kind of look at is which teams are maybe we can expect more from or less from in the coming season. Adam, who do you see kind of falling away maybe in the Premier League as we go into the new year?
Burnley for me.
No two ways about
that.
Can you quantify that? Or you just don't like them?
Just don't like them. No, I can quantify it. I've got a few stats here. So they've won 5 and drawn 2 of their 15 matches, which, considering how well they've played, is ridiculous. They've been outshot in every game they've picked up points in, aside from the win over Watford, where they won more shot. Tom Heaton's made 165 saves, which is more than any other team. And only Middlesbrough have had fewer shots to Burnley's 143. And that, there's reasons for that as well. Borough are more measured in their play. They keep the ball a lot at the back.
Yeah, so in effect, they're just Middlesbrough better at defending and therefore...
Yeah, exactly. So that means that they have less shots overall.
Yeah, of course, understand.
And so you'd expect Burnley to regress to more expected results as the season goes on.
A massive part of Burnley's form has been their home form, in effect. Have they just been lucky at home, do you think? Or is it a case of Turf Moor is not a very nice place to go?
Yeah, no, I just think that the teams will start winning there. I think that, as the stats show, they've been lucky to win those games at home. And let's not forget that they've had another home game as well. They played Liverpool at the start when Liverpool Stadium wasn't quite ready.
Yeah.
People forget that.
Very true.
You know. So they've got, you know, another away game, and I think that's why their odds on still to go down.
So beware, Burnley fans who are listening.
Yeah.
Adam Cheng has spoken and you will be in for a year of struggle. Maybe I can come to you, John, with a more positive outlook and ask you for a team who you think will start to pick up points in the new year.
Yeah, so I've been working on a sort of Premier League prediction model recently, which we just published the first iteration. I'll talk a bit more about that later. But as well as totally backing up Adam's shout there on Burnley to regress, I've got the biggest difference essentially between the Premier League table as it looks now and the Premier League table as my model thinks it will look is Southampton. And obviously part of that is just because the middle of the table is so cramped at the moment that any little swing can shift a team a few positions, but essentially all the numbers suggest, so this is like shot numbers, points per game ratios, that kind of stuff, this all suggests that Southampton are going to swing upwards, and essentially it suggests that they're actually quite clearly the seventh best team in the league. So after what I think is widely established as the big six, then comes Saints, so above Everton, sort of notably above Everton. And I think for me it's interesting, so the numbers obviously show that, but it's interesting to think about the fact that there's so much evidence now that Saints just have a great system there, because managerial changes keep happening, players come and go, but the quality of the team remains the same. And I mean, I know Everton got a good result last night, but the evidence essentially is that someone like Koeman perhaps may actually have benefited from being at such a well-run club, and perhaps is now finding that when the system isn't as well established, he finds things a little bit tougher. So Saints for me, The numbers suggest it and the theory suggests it. So,
but when we say the numbers, are we talking expected goals? Are we talking their shot data? What, so, what are we looking at?
So I, annoyingly, the FT doesn't have budget for Opta data. So my model doesn't use expected goals because obviously you need events data for that. So it's shot numbers, game state, so percentage of time team spend at different score differentials. It's essentially, it's all of the publicly available data that goes into that. So it's exactly the same approach you would use if you had expected goals as well. But I guess the inputs are sort of silver level rather than gold level, as it were.
Okay. Well, yeah. So good news for Saints fans. Maybe after the injury to Charlie Austin, there is a reason to be merry this Christmas anyway. Sanj.
Yes.
Another team going back to teams who may struggle in the new year. I know there's someone who you think...
Yeah, there is. Before I talk about them, just very quickly on Southampton, my analysis says exactly what yours has, John, so kind of verifying that. But even on a very high level, we'll actually give some numbers and why I thought Southampton was a particularly interesting one. And obviously 11th in the table right now, but a really good way of looking at this is not just shots, but shots inside the area, which you only dive further deep into that and you get into XPG world, expected goals world. But they've had 140 shots inside the area, and it is, there's only five teams above them, and it's who you'd expect them to be who have had that. And in terms on the other side, in terms of conceding shots in their area, there's only five teams better than them at stopping that as well. So the numbers do hold. So that kind of makes sense.
And a word on that, because that's definitely a metric that I find very useful, is looking at shots inside the area. And Palace are another team who actually are performing very well inside the area. I think specifically Benteke's had the third most shots inside the area than any other Premier League player. And Wilfried Zaha's also, had 20, which is in the top 20 as well. So maybe they're another team who I mean, but they are quite free scoring, I suppose.
Yeah, I think a lot of data would suggest that we should be more free scoring. Yeah, actually, definitely. Considering the tools that they have to their advantage. More on Zaha to come. Yes. But the other one that I'll probably want to talk about is Watford, currently ninth in the table, using the same kind of methodology. They shouldn't be anywhere near that, really. They really shouldn't. And actually, when you do start to dive into a lot of their games, you can see quite a lot of tactical naivety, actually. In some of the games, I remember the Liverpool game. They're the only team that kind of came out to try and take on Klopp's team when they had their full roster of strikers out, and they got pummeled 5-1. And it genuinely could have been 10. And I just didn't understand why they were playing like that.
Yeah, they've been really poor when I've seen them.
Yeah.
I can't believe they're ninth in the table.
What's very odd about Watford is that Walter Mazzarri came in with his reputation to kind of make strikers suddenly great. I think he's attributed with a lot of praise for making Cavani the chance creator, maybe not goal scorer, sharpshooter that he is. Obviously, gets himself into amazing goal scoring positions. But yet, he came into a club at Watford who had a plethora of very good strikers and seemingly has somewhat blunted them.
Yeah.
So that's something to be worried about. But Adam, could it be a case, as we spoke earlier, of new managers coming into the Premier League? Could Mazzarri be one who's just taking time to figure out his system and picking up the points?
Exactly. I think that's quite possibly the case. Yeah.
Good stuff. So, Any other teams that people looking ahead want to talk about for next year?
I would say it's going to be an interesting window. I don't know what the big guys are going to be doing, but it does seem like if there is a striker out there, one of those top four is going to go get them, because there needs to be some more goals in this top four.
I'd say Manchester United are the obvious ones that have been unlucky so far this season. I mean, Mourinho has been banging on about it, but there is some truth to his claims. I mean, the home draws with Stoke, Burnley, Arsenal, West Ham, the shot data for those games really should have meant that United won those games, but they didn't. And I expect them to improve, not necessarily to make the top four, but yeah.
And that's improve in terms of points rather than performances.
Exactly, yeah.
And just in terms, I guess, of your January shout, I think like Draxler's an obvious interesting one to talk about his willingness to leave at the moment. And for me, it'd be interesting to see if, whether we're talking about Draxler or not, to see if Liverpool look to strengthen. I mean, obviously Mane is going to be away for a bit of the African Nations, but one thing that seems to have been quite obvious in the data is that Liverpool's conversion rates at least have dropped when they've been missing key players. Obviously Coutinho, who had emerged as really, really world-class talent this season. I actually have him as more than doubling his goal production rate and his contribution relative to the rest of the team, and he's gone and the results have dropped, so a bit of a thin squad there. So
I think that one of the biggest changes there has actually been Firmino not playing at nine anymore and moving to the left to accommodate Origi, with Sturridge being out injured as well. And that really, really impacts Liverpool in terms of creation, but also pressing, because that's where they like to get the chances from.
And I think Firmino is maybe someone who operates best when he's been able to drift kind of inside and outside, and absolutely, that's what Origi does as well. So even though Origi's scoring goals, maybe it's not been too beneficial for Liverpool.
Yeah, look, Origi's got 4 and 4 and 4. Like, no one's talking about it, but he's in great form. But Firmino is one of the best nines in the division when he's playing there.
And the last point on Liverpool is that there seems to be a concern. I mean, we should probably talk about Loris Karius. And there seems to be a few people from kind of around the analytical world who seem to be defending him somewhat, saying that actually the chances that Liverpool are conceding are comfortably the kind of best, highest chance of scoring chances in the league. So, Sanj, as someone who sees a fair bit of Liverpool, what do Liverpool have to do to prevent these kind of high goal-scoring chances?
Well, number one, I don't. My personal opinion is he shouldn't be dropped. I don't think that's the right thing to do, right way to manage that kind of situation, especially when your backup is Simon Mignolet. But one of the problems that this team has is the defensive pairing hasn't been stable, but when it has been stable, we've done actually very, very well. We've conceded not very many big chances at all. I think it's at one a game when Matip and Lovren have been playing steadily together. And the goals that we were conceding were, if you remember, the bizarre Lovren kick against Crystal Palace, which just kicked it straight up. It was bizarre stuff that we were conceding. And I think a lot of the Liverpool analytics community certainly were looking at, like, well, this should regress. Like, as time goes on, we can't keep on giving away silly chances. But I think what's becoming very, very evident is, well, two things. One, Matip's incredible. If he was any more Rolls Royce, he'd be nationalised. and the second one is Lovren really needs Matip. He really needs a fantastic defender alongside of him. In the first half against Bournemouth, he actually thought he played really well. From the stands, it looked like he was having a good game. And then Lucas had a few shoddy moments, and then suddenly there's big brain farts going on everywhere. A lot of it may actually also come down to letting people run at the defence. And that's what happens when you're pressing so high. If somebody does escape your press that early up the pitch, then they will run at you and they will have space to run at you. Mm. So you need defenders to be able to deal with that situation. And the biggest thing for me actually was Sarko, because he was doing very, very well until the drugs ban, which wasn't the drugs ban, missed the Europa League final. Cheers for that, UEFA. Thank you very much. But he was fantastic before that. He really, really was. And that's why Liverpool didn't go out and buy another defender to back up Lovren, which is why you see Lucas playing there. You got Klavan, but he's not really that good enough. So Sarko was supposed to be that guy. It was supposed to be Sarko and Matip, I believe.
Interesting. And I think that there's a lot of speculation about Virgil van Dijk being the answer to both City and Liverpool's. Because of the two...
Maybe we can share him.
In the Premier League, I mean, it's amazing that the two of the strongest teams in the league are the two who are giving away chances with the highest chance of the opposition scoring. But, so we're going to kind of widen our what we're looking at the moment and look at how maybe tactical shifts will happen in 2017. Adam, I think if you look at the big winners of 2016, you've got Leicester, who obviously won the Premier League. You've got Real Madrid, and who won the Champions League. And you've got Portugal, who won the European Championships. These are three teams, Leicester and Portugal specifically, who didn't particularly enjoy being in possession of the football. And even in the Champions League final, despite Real Madrid obviously enjoying a lot of possession throughout the season, Real Madrid very much sat back and let Atletico kind of come to them and keep hold of the ball. Is this going to be the same in 2016? Is possession football a dying breed? Are we going to see more counter-attacking and pressing football?
I don't necessarily agree that possession football is dying. Those examples are good examples of teams that have used non-possession approaches to win football matches. However, I believe that those examples have featured teams that have been lucky. I mean, it's very difficult to say that over 38 game season, Leicester were lucky to win the league, but on the figures, they were lucky. They were eighth behind Everton and West Ham in shots on target total last season. Everything went for them, didn't it? You know, they didn't have any injuries. They had a settled side for the whole season. All their rivals were dropping points where they shouldn't have been.
I think Morgan played like every minute.
Morgan
and Schmeichel played like every minute.
Yeah, I think exactly. Mm. Yeah. And the fullbacks weren't too far behind as well. I think only the red card at Arsenal stopped Danny Simpson for doing the same. And and with regards to Portugal, what I call tournament theory, where it takes seven matches to win a tournament. They weren't the best team in the Euros. Either France or Germany were. They won one game in 90 minutes, the semi-final against Wales. And, you know, they scrambled to victory in the final after extra time in a game they should have probably lost in 90. So I wouldn't necessarily say that that style of football is going to be ultimately successful for the top teams. If anything, I'd say that possession football is on the increase. If you go down to the Championship, which is, I watch a lot of football in the Championship, teams seemingly now are playing more possession football than they have been previously. Teams like Reading and Fulham knock the ball about, you know, more than any team has done on that level before. And that's at that level. And then at a higher level, Barcelona are, at the end of last season, they were playing less possession football. But now I think they're getting back to playing more possession football. Their possession stats are as high as they've been for a while.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think with Barcelona, they seem to change their means of possession football somewhat, and we're looking to play it around the back more so than in midfield. And you know, Liverpool are a team as well. I mean, I don't want to talk about them too much. We've already discussed them.
No, we can. It's fine.
But I mean, Jurgen Klopp said when he was on Monday Night Football, he said, you know, everyone talks about this pressing game, but we're a possession team. John, is it more a case maybe of possession football changing as we look into 2017 rather than it kind of dying? Do you think?
Yeah, or I mean, for me, to be honest, I think just the very use of the term as an umbrella, I think frustrates me a little bit, because for me, Leicester were a totally unique beast last season. And to group them in there with Portugal and say these teams played the same approach, I think is a bit of a sort of a category mistake. I mean, for me, Portugal's strategy was more negative. It was to, you know, restrict opposition's opportunities and get the ball to Ronaldo, and he would hit pot shots as he does. And I guess you could almost say that's also Real Madrid's exact approach, although obviously with a bit more talent in there. Whereas Leicester was much more about those famous, extremely rapid and vertical attacks. It was obviously Kante was a huge factor in allowing them to play that style as well. So for me, it's less about possession versus non-possession, more about, yeah, well, pressing, fluidity, you know, rapid interchange, having players that can just swap around and play the same positions, as we're seeing, as we've said here, with Liverpool, with City, Arsenal, Spurs. It's all these teams essentially who have a huge cluster of attacking players who can play anywhere from the wing to attacking mid to a lone striker. I think for me, that is what we're seeing take off. It's this idea of the sort of creation. We used to talk about false tens and false nines, but that's now false everything.
Right? Yeah.
It's these players who can play everywhere. And I think for me, that is the trend. And when you talk about the likes of Fulham and Reading, I think what we're seeing is a trickle-down effect. Like, teams are being smarter. There's increasing acceptance, I think, to use evidence to be smart about this stuff rather than just say, you know, run harder, although certain Swansea interviewees may disagree. But yeah, so I think it's a long-awaited increase in footballing intelligence rather than a move towards possession or, you know, a certain 3-4 whatever per se.
I think that's probably, using the Reading and Fulham examples again, it's due to, as you say, a rising football intelligence. It's due to analytics. It's due to people understanding now what does actually win football matches. And the buzzword of the moment, I would say, in football is certainly pressing, or the press. I think you can't really listen or read any report of any fixture.
The press love talking about the press.
The press love talking about the press. And now we have the counter press and the counter press. Reading reports of how United stopped Spurs' press with their own counter press, which then pressed again. Sanj, what is this going to continue in 2017? Are the presses going to keep winning, or is there going to be a means to stop this high-intensity football?
There absolutely is a means to stop this high-intensity football. And that doesn't necessarily mean it will happen. Obviously, if someone's pressing very, very high up the pitch, you've got two options. You either break their press, and you've worked hard to figure out what that angle is, and you've got someone in the right place. Really good example was Manchester United away to Liverpool, the 0-0. Went to that game as well. Boring one. but actually, no, it was really interesting in the fact that that's what Mourinho chose to do. Sacrifice the game by putting Pogba and Ibrahimovic in really defined places that he knew just wouldn't allow Liverpool to kind of play out. So that was also kind of an anti-press in a way. It's really weird. We can just keep on making up this kind of stuff. But the other option is obviously knock it over the top.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't see anything wrong with that. And I've seen a few teams employ that tradition, do our pressing teams, because they know that other teams will try and break their press. So what can we do to throw them off? Get a long ball over the top. Actually, Liverpool, Bournemouth, two of the goals are just straight over the top, and Liverpool never usually play like that. They knew that Bournemouth were going to come at them to try and disrupt the press. So that one begets the other, I think.
I think that's completely right. And anyone who saw that Spurs Man United game, Rojo and Jones, between them, completed just 9 passes in the game. Rojo completed 3 passes in the whole fixture against Spurs. Basically, you know, their tactic was, if you're going to run at us, we're just going to kick the ball over your head and make you run back again. We're not going to give you any time to press us. The other big story within football tactics at the moment, which will certainly roll on into 2017 and beyond, is the old three at the back. We've seen Conte hailed a genius for implementing a system. He's been playing for 10 years at both Juventus and Italy. and it's got me personally questioning why it took him so long to implement it at Chelsea. John, is this three in the back? Is this going to be the future of football? Is this the new success? Is this how everyone's going to play in by the end of 2017?
So I think, again, at risk of just being the skeptic in the room, I do think we have the same problem here of pretending that three at the back is this term where this team plays three at the back and this team plays three at the back, so they're the same. Whereas we can clearly see that, say, Chelsea and City, who on the one hand do kind of play three at the back, they play very different systems. However, I do think there is, you know, just sort of in terms of the way shape and space work, just the way the numbers work, there is an obvious added flexibility of that system over 4-4-2, like the ability of that third centre, well, essentially either a sweeper or a holding midfielder. There's that inherent flexibility allows teams to adjust to different situations better. Similarly, the wing backs who can, if you've got the right players with the right engines, to use that old cliche, James Milner, for example, they can be left back 1 minute, left wing the next minute, centre mid the next, famously with Pep. So I think it's less about the fact that it's three at the back and more, again, coming back to this idea of players who can shift seamlessly depending on attack, defence, that kind of thing. So if we take three at the back as a sort of a proxy for this smarter football, then I'd say yes, and we'll probably see that, you know, be adopted wider and wider. I think it'll probably end up being the teams with more limited sort of tactical intelligence who stick to the 4-4-2, because that allows them to be more rule-based. I think essentially what you end up with is teams that will play 4-4-2 are teams whose players learn by rote. It's like, here's how you react in this situation. Whereas if you trust your players to play three at the back, you're essentially trusting them to be more intelligent, react to situations themselves. And there's maybe a question there of, are City's back line ready for that level of responsibility yet? Which last weekend might suggest they're not. But I think it's this move to giving players more independence.
It's tactical fluidity as opposed to...
As opposed to any specific set of numbers. Yeah.
It's also about the ability of the players as well.
Yeah.
Like, totally. To play those sort of unorthodox systems, you need good players, which is, you know, why the lower teams are still sticking with four at the back.
I massively agree. I think actually, I don't think that many teams will adopt 3-5-2 because of the personnel you need to be able to do it. Like, this summer, everyone's like, why are you buying David Luiz back? Why are you doing this? I was like, you're mental. This is crazy. I was like, that's why you're doing it. Yeah. And this is very specific people you need in that team. You need that Kante. And actually, Matic has really, with players that have improved this season, like Matic has really stepped up. At the start of the season, he was awful. He's really figured it out. But to have diamonds like Hazard and Costa to be able to make that happen at the front, I think that's really, really important. So I don't know how many teams have got that Victor Moses in them, and that I don't think Victor Moses knew he had Victor Moses in them, but and Alonso, you know, it's specific skill set.
For Chelsea, it's so important that those players stay fit as well, isn't it?
Massive.
You know, as you said, like Moses, Hazard and Alonso. You know, obviously, Matic was missing in the game away to City, and they managed to win that game sort of undeservedly. But generally speaking, I'd say Chelsea are quite sort of at risk.
It's interesting with Chelsea, they seem to be very kind of rigid in this fluid system, and that's why it works in a way. Like every player is very, very much knows their job.
Yeah, it's brilliant to watch. Great to watch.
Fantastic. And another team who played through the back that I'd implore any listeners to watch is Julian Nagelsmann's Hoffenheim, who play this incredible system of having two centre midfielders who are encouraged to basically carry the ball wide. I mean, I don't know what you'd call them. I call them a wide central midfielders in one article and got slightly panned for it. I'd employ you to watch them, specifically Karem Demirbe, who's a very exciting talent. Are there any teams that you guys look at? I mean, we've praised some managers' tactics, but any teams you look at in 2017 who have to change what they're doing, who aren't doing it, doing it right?
It's going to be really interesting seeing what Diego Simeone does at the end of this season. Mm. My gut tells me he's going to go. For another challenge, and we've heard his son saying, oh, he'll always go back to Inter because that's where his heart is. Da, da, da. It'd be great to see him in the Premier League and just some of the mad stuff he gets up to.
Keep racking up the big-name managers.
It'd be insane. But he's so integral to the philosophy and style of that team. And they've had so much success and you know, they've been unlucky in a lot of ways. But what happens to Atletico? We all know Atletico is like, such a strong defensive side, tactically very astute, pounce quickly. They like to use the wings. What's going to happen? What's going to happen to them? Because if he goes, then there's at least a couple of Greek players like Griezmann who will probably go as well. So I think that's going to be really interesting what happens tactically.
It's been a few times this season. They've looked a shadow of the team they have in previous years.
So I think there's maybe, you know, as someone who probably hasn't watched La Liga as much as you guys, but it strikes me there's maybe similarities with Dortmund's in Klopp's last season that performances drop off a little bit, but if the club is able to maintain its identity and its systems and get in, you know, a Tuchel, then they're able to keep that going. And so, as you say, the key is, can they convince the players? Yep. Number one, can they convince the players to stay and that things are going to remain the same? Number two, can they take what is perhaps Simeone's identity and make it Atleti's identity?
Yeah.
Interesting. And there's, I mean, something I've thought for a while is a Lucien Favre would be a very interesting appointment at Atleti, who's obviously taking Nice to the heady heights of Ligue 1. And also, I always get confused with the Simeone to Arsenal links. It seems, strikes me as
I would love to see it though. Yeah. I'd pay to see that.
That's just Arsenal's Twitter game.
Carl Henry to Man City, in my view. It's just very odd. So moving forward, let's talk more about kind of how you guys are kind of measuring performances and what we can look forward to in 2017. I know, obviously, Adam working in gambling as he does has obviously got his own model of things. So if you could just give us a kind of a brief outline of what you look at and what you can expect in 2017.
Yeah, we've got our own model that we're testing at the moment. It's got three main sort of sub-parts to it. First part is the team part. So from the data we get from Opta, we can generate attack and defence rating for each team. That can then be put into the system and it can give us likelihoods of teams winning. The second part is the player part. Along the same lines, you give each player a defence and attack rating, and the positive of that is that if a player's missing, then you can take him out and it will affect the price that team comes out to win accordingly.
Can you give us a brief insight into what goes into the attack and defence rating?
So it's from Opta, everything that we receive goes into performance score, the score performance score that is used for the player model.
Okay.
So it's every contribution they make on the pitch, essentially interceptions, passes. It's weighted in terms of league. So if a player's played in France and then moves to England, then that rating will adjust accordingly.
Yeah.
And the third part is the market part of it. So it's the price that each team has gone off in previous weeks. And that basically means that any changes which have occurred recently are taken into account, and all those three things come together to give us insight into what price a team should be to win. And then we can also apply that to the overall season if we run it for every game, and then you can come up with what the league table is going to finish.
And interesting, as you said there, that if each player is also attributed a score, maybe you can give some insight into how much kind of team news really does matter.
It does. I mean, obviously, some players matter more than others. So Messi, for example, he contributes so much to Barcelona, 0.6 goals difference when Messi's playing to their goals for one game, which is enormous. Other players, less so. And, you know, there's a few surprises in there, players that actually don't have an effect.
And presumably there are some who the team play better when they're not playing.
When they're not playing, exactly. Yeah. But we won't make names. Any
examples there?
No.
Any friends we can make on the school
football? Don't upset anyone.
We praise Messi, so it's only right to go the other way. John, I know you also have a model, kind of a predictive model or the like. How do you work out your... I know you've gone into it briefly already, but just tell us a bit more about it.
Yeah, so it sounds like we're having a bit of a model off over in the corner here.
Sounds like it's yours as well.
Model off.
Sounds quite similar. So this is essentially... The idea is something I've been toying around with for a couple of years, at risk of revealing how much of a complete nerd I am. But I've been essentially doing a lot of reading around, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants, as it were, looking at other people's work. And Sander Ejietsma, who the Dutch analyst who runs 11 Taken 11, has a particularly comprehensive description of his model, which uses expected goals as its input. I essentially attempted to replicate that, but as I said, using the sort of the light version in terms of not having access to XG, but using all shot numbers, shots on target, goals ratios, points ratios, game states, that kind of stuff. But the key thing that I guess I want to stress with mine is that there's a lot of, with football stats, there's this, a lot of people who are just happy to throw numbers around. But one thing that, you know, the really smart guys in this space emphasize is you need evidence that your work, your model is actually, you know, worth people's time looking at it. So the thing I've been keen to do this time is make sure I can show that it is, that looking at my predicted table is actually, you know, telling you more. It's got more information in there than looking at the league table. So some analysis I actually ran yesterday shows that essentially if you look at the correlation between where a team is in the table at any given day and where it finishes, and you compare that to the correlation between where our model says it would finish on that same day to where it would end up, the model tends to be about 15% more accurate. That changes over the course of a season. It's particularly accurate in sort of the middle third of the season, as it were. Obviously, the longer time goes on, the more close to reality the actual table is. But the key there is that when you look at the predictive model outputs that we've got at the moment, you should be getting more insight measurably than in reality. And just to go a little bit of detail at risk of rambling on too much about how it works,
what it's all about.
Awesome. So the starting point is essentially to calculate all these rolling average stats for each team as seasons progresses, going back for as long as we have data, which is over about 15 seasons. And then you essentially look at the correlation between these teams' underlying stats and how many goals they scored and conceded in the very next match. So you're looking, it's not just based on what I think would be significant, it's based on things that are statistically significantly correlated with goals scored and conceded. So that is our way of calculating the attack and defence ratings, that kind of like what Adam was talking about. So you end up with something saying like if a team has like this number of points per game, this number of shots per game, this number of shots conceded per game, blah, 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 then it has an attacking rating of this and a defensive rating of this. Then you can also look at home advantage, and then the ultimate output is that you can simulate the result of any match. That allows me to then go away and say, right, simulate all the remaining matches in the season, do that a few thousand times to make sure we've got a solid answer, and then here's what the table looks like. So at the moment, we're saying Chelsea about 62% chance of winning the league. Obviously, prediction models can be wrong. I believe I might be correct in saying that Donald Trump wasn't Nate Silver's favourite to win. So actually, that's probably a good way of framing it. We've got Chelsea with about the same chance as 538 had Hillary Clinton. There's my football US election crossover. I mean, obviously there are more candidates, as it were, for the Premier League, which probably makes Chelsea's chances more likely. But yeah, so Chelsea looking likely to win. But the nice thing is, after every round of matches is played, we know more information about the league, the numbers are updated, so that will keep developing over the season. So yeah, keep tabs.
Well, yeah, certainly. I know a couple of days ago you posted a graphic of your prediction model on Twitter, and also on the baseline on the FT website. If you want to see John's graphics, definitely have a look at them both on his Twitter account, John Byrne Murdoch, or look at the baseline on the FT for football and many other things.
Awesome, man. I didn't even have to pay for that.
I know.
Fantastic.
Yeah. You can get me a pint.
Yeah.
I take coffee or beer.
Excellent.
Sanj, are there any areas of kind of football analytics or ways that people are looking at football that you expect or that you want to explore more deeply in the future? I know you're someone who gets quite stuck into the analytics podcasts and such.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny one from... Put my Squawker corporate hat on. It's a funny one for us because, you know, in 2012 we started creating these match centres and really allowing access to deep level of data, and you know, we started to build a business around that in certain ways, and maybe what we didn't do was dive even further into the data and do even more exploration, and that's kind of what I think we'll be doing now, especially with Football IQ, and that's kind of the point of a lot of this. What I'm really interested in is seeing some of the newer work, and if you guys seen Penalty Kick Stat,
yep,
is really cool.
Yeah,
we
really
did
good.
Some stuff. Yeah. I find that stuff really interesting.
Yeah,
really focusing in on a niche and really diving into data, and you can follow him in at Penalty Kick Stat. We're not getting paid for these plugs. It's just cool. Just cool stuff.
A friend of the firm.
He's a friend of the firm. I think some stuff that Paul Riley does is really, really cool. And 11 Tech 11, obviously. There's a load of really, really good guys out there. And I think we kind of owe it to ourselves and to football generally to get more stuck in that part, because we have such a good opportunity now to help educate normal football fans on that next level, because that's what happened so far, right? You know, 5 years ago, no one's really talking about possession-based football and this kind of stuff. No one's looking at the numbers and sitting in a room like us talking about it. And it's about finding that next level. And the other thing I'm really interested in is off-the-ball data and looking at how we can kind of bring that into the fold and really use that in terms of our analysis, not just on the content side of things, but also on the gaming side of things. I think some really, really fascinating new businesses popping up there.
Yeah, I think just to pick up on a couple of Sanjay's points there, I think the off the ball stuff is something, it's the default answer now to what you're looking forward to next in analytics. You know, companies like TrackAB are starting to work with clubs. We've not yet seen that enter into the public domain or the scrapable domain, as it were.
which is the public domain, isn't it?
Yeah. But... I mean, the obvious value add there will be things like adding defensive pressure to expected goals models, yep, and that kind of thing, yep, so that someone is shooting through a crowd of players and someone is shooting in front of the keeper is quantified differently. In terms of specific new work I've seen, I somehow managed to forget the guy's name, but it was a guest post for StatsBomb recently looking at areas of the pitch from which passes are most dangerous. And it was looking at this idea of the half spaces, so for the less statistically... there's less in on the stats grammar, those are the areas of the pitch sort of your, if you divide the pitch into fifths from touchline to touchline, it's your sort of second and fourth, so not right on the bylines, not in the centre. And I think, so I mean, number one, that's just interesting to know that essentially crossing from out wide is less valuable than playing it from playing balls in from slightly inside, but that's actually more valuable than playing from the centre. The idea being that the centre of the pitch gets very crowded, the wings are just not very efficient, so it's the half spaces where the action comes from. But it's also interesting then to think about the impact of that or how that relates to the tactical changes we've seen. So again, I think playing 4-4-2 is essentially your players are in the crowded centre and in the ineffective wings. So again, these more fluid systems, think about how many goals we see where it's someone cutting in from sort of the corner of the penalty area or playing through balls from there. So we're clearly seeing that teams have maybe picked up on that. So lots of interesting stuff there. And it'll be interesting, I think, to see how that stuff gets incorporated into the way teams are.
It's quite funny,
up,
isn't it? Because I think, especially in this country, on broadcast, there's definitely been a reticence. And luckily, I think we can, not just us, but other people in our space have helped drive it forward for, you know, things like Monday Night Football, etc. But I don't know if you guys seen the example of in Germany, in Sky Germany, when Klopp was on there and they started talking about packing, they started talking about impact. And this is like to a normal audience, yeah, it's a really, really interesting way to define it. It's like, wow, if you guys can like explain this to an audience really, really well, then surely we should be doing more in this country as
and,
well
and
on
it's
broadcast.
It's so frustrating that at the moment all we get given by our kind of football coverage on TV is just distance covered and sprints, which is, you know, let's not
get into that.
When it's not put into any context or anything at all, it is largely useless. I think we can all agree.
What I would say about models, sorry, one final thing, is that I don't think there's any model that can trump the human eye. I'm a keen gambler, and in my experience, I've had more success in betting on things on the base of what I've seen rather than models. Obviously, all this stuff helps, and the more the merrier. But I think if you had the time to watch every single game that happened, you would have more of an understanding.
I thought you did do that, Chingy.
I'll do my best.
So I think to offer a counterpoint to that, but not by no means totally disagreeing. I think for me, it's about scale. And I think individual bets, your eye can definitely trump because you've got, you know, specific insights about a specific team, like who's going to win this match, that kind of thing.
But the overall picture, I'm with you.
Exactly. Yeah. For me, it's big picture where the model is, you know, it's simulating like thousands of games. And I think that just scales things out. It allows you to look at, an event that's not happening for months at the end of a season. Probably at this point with a little bit more, a little bit more smartly than you would just by saying, I think this is going to happen, that's going to happen. So I think there's definitely, both are important. It's like the old, like, is analytics the future? Is analytics shit argument? No, it's a bit of
it's quantitative, qualitative, right?
Yeah. So totally, and obviously, if you've got models, just having more insight, more knowledge, watching more football is going to help you work out how to interpret those models anyway. Yeah. So by no means suggesting everyone stop going to games, stop watching games, just sit in front of a spreadsheet. A bit of everything.
I think that comes up with maybe the Karius point that some people who are saying that he shouldn't be criticised maybe haven't watched some of the clangers that he's made, possibly.
True.
Which is a bit frustrating. Finally, we are going to put our necks on the line. We've already spoken about some of the teams we think are underperforming, but we're going to talk about, I'm going to open it to the floor and ask you for just give me one team that you think are going to have a really good 2017. Just to put this into context, Crystal Palace have played, 30, at time of recording, 38 games this season and have won in the Premier League and have won 6 of them. They came into the new year in 5th place, 5 points behind Tottenham in 4th. So a lot can change in a year. Adam, who's your one team that you can plump forward to have a strong 2017 or a weak one if you'd rather?
Well, I touched on it earlier, but Manchester City, I feel, are the team to follow in 2017. Every analytic I see has them and Liverpool as far clear of the rest of the Premier League. And as I said earlier, I think Guardiola's still sort of finding his feet, as it were, getting to know his best team. And I think people have gone overboard recently with the criticism of City, and I just think they'll pick up, and our models have them finishing it up.
Good stuff. Well, let's hope Pep. Pep's still on the job at the end of 2017.
I think that's certain.
John, anyone that you can see having a very strong or very weak 2017?
I mean, it's not saying anything we've not already said, really. But just to recap, essentially, I think Saints looking good. I think also the fact, obviously, that they were knocked out of Europa League was really disappointing. But you know, second half of the season, when Europe comes back, they'll benefit from the extra rest. And I think it essentially, assuming they hold on to everyone over January and perhaps get someone in to replace Austin while he's out. I think they'll be nailed on for 7th, and they'll do pretty well.
Good stuff. And Sanj, I'm going to maybe put you on the spot slightly here and ask you for maybe someone in Europe that you think you're going to over or under.
Well, I think I was really hoping to come into here and say Leipzig were overperforming. I don't think they are.
Yeah.
I think they're actually bang on where they should be. I think they will drop a little bit. I think that in Italy, it's all pretty stable. In Spain, you've got the same kind of guys there.
Yeah.
I mean, you can look at Nice. I think Nice is a really, really interesting one. Having a look at data there and whether or not they're actually going to sustain what they have been doing. To keep hold of the manager, that's the start.
Exactly, yeah. You know, he's doing an absolutely superb job. I'm going to stick my neck out and say that Monaco are going to be the team to be found out. They are blowing very hot at the moment, scoring at a ridiculous rate, and I can't see them continuing to score at the rate they are, judging by the chances they're creating. Moving on to players now. Any players that we see as having a big year coming up?
Zaha, you talked about Palace earlier on.
Yes.
So I think fundamental to Palace rising up the table and doing well in 2017 is keeping hold of Zaha. The guy is a take-on machine. He absolutely is. He's comparatively up there with Hazard on numbers. He's winning 61% of his take-ons. That's insane. And for like 50-plus take-ons, that is crazy. And the news this morning linking him with Spurs, I think it'd be a great signing for Spurs because that's kind of what they need, because if they can get more attacking force, then I see a big 2017 for them. You know, the defence is so super solid. They still have actually a decent amount of shots in the area. And don't concede many at all. So if they can just get a bit more in that penalty area. So Zaha for both player and team, potentially, depending on where he goes.
Exactly, and hopefully...
Just to chip in on the Zaha thing, it'll be interesting to see if he does go to a big team. Obviously, it didn't work out at United, but to see if he's able to sort of evolve, essentially, to tailor his role to a new system, because I've heard a lot of really interesting stuff recently, a lot of it, I think, from James York on the StatsBomb podcast about Coutinho and the idea that part of Coutinho's improvement this season is because the fact that he's part of a better system, a better set of players, means that he's less likely to hit pot shots, more likely to play intelligently, shoot from closer in, pass, that kind of thing. And I think we see the same thing. I think maybe Zaha's shot numbers this year are inflated because he doesn't trust a lot of his teammates, so he shoots. If he goes into a better system, is he able to tailor his game so that his reduction in shot numbers doesn't hurt him, and it instead means he's shooting from better and passing the ball more? But yeah, a really interesting one to
watch. I definitely
think
he's evolving as a player. He's got 6 assists this season as well. That's doing well.
It's easy to forget he's 23 years old. And also, just a little stat for you, he'd only made 4 Premier League assists before this season. He's now got 6 for the season. That's including his ill-fated loan spell at Cardiff when he was at Manchester United as well, and his 2 substitute appearances for United. Oh, yeah.
I think he's quite a confidence player, isn't he? And certainly, you know, he's just at the top of his game at the moment. And I think that's showing.
Before when he moved to United, he had never played a minute of Premier League football, and he was a young kid, and it didn't really work out for him there because David Moyes wasn't willing to trust him in the most important couple of months of his managerial career. I think maybe the time is right. I agree with you guys that for him to join another big club. Sorry, Palace fans. Any managers, last but not least, who we can see having a strong 2017? Maybe some young managers who we can see coming to the fore?
Obviously, really, really liking what Eddie Howe's doing. It just seems like a genuinely lovely bloke as well, doesn't he? Like, I've read some really lovely stories from around the grounds as well, actually, about how nice he is to staff opposition grounds and to fans that he just meets on the streets and stuff. And I think tactically, he's getting there, I think. I'm really, really impressed. At time of recording, they are 8th in the table. There will be more games tonight. And they're doing an absolutely stonking job. I think one interesting one to watch be Pardew. What is Pards? It's really hard to know, isn't it? so much depends. I would say stay with him. I don't think it'd be wrong to get rid if they go in for another bad patch.
I think certainly the most important thing to stay in the Premier League seems to be scoring goals, and that's something they are doing at the moment. A word on Eddie Howe just before we end. I mean, would it be fair to say that if he was not British and he was doing this in a foreign league, we'd be gazing at him with lustful eyes, maybe. The press,
are we not? I think the press are, aren't they?
Somewhat. I mean, he's been doing it for a long while now. It's not a case the last couple of months, which is when he's really come to the fore.
He wasn't really in the running for the England job when he should have been, though, was he?
I think he was mentioned.
He was mentioned, but he probably should have been named England manager.
Well, we had Jeff Mostyn in, didn't we? Last week, Bournemouth chairman, and we asked him about Eddie Howe, and he said he will be an elite manager at one point. Obviously, he would say that, wouldn't not say that. But I kind of believe him, I think. We haven't got many more young English managers coming up.
So it's a nice way to end that we've got a young English manager in Eddie Howe and a young, maybe English, maybe Ivorian winger in Wilfried Zaha, who we can praise. Thank you very, very much for listening. Thank you for joining us, Adam.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us, John.
Yes.
And thanks, Sanj, as well.
Pleasure to be here.
Please tune in to the next Squawker Football IQ podcast, where we'll be looking... It'll be a January transfer window special with a special guest whose identity will soon be revealed. Thank you very much for listening, and speak to you soon.